Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Man, 2020 has been the craziest year in the world, and if you aren't thinking about getting yourself prepared, then you need to have your head examined. Go check out My Patriot Supply. We've done a deal with them. We've got our own website. We'll get you a discount for it. You go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com, and right now they're running a discount on 4-week supply. People that sign up through our website get $100 off of these orders. You owe it to yourself. You owe it to your family. If you've watched the first half of 2020 unfold the way it is, and you're not thinking about getting prepared, then I don't know what to tell you. I mean, listen, they've got emergency survival food, long-term, short-term, bulk meat and protein kits. They've got all kinds of stuff, survival items, cooking gear, power and lighting, water filtration systems. I mean, it used to be that you would buy these sorts of things in case there might be an emergency like a earthquake or a flood or something like that. Now, every single day seems like a bigger emergency than the one before. Go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com. Take a look at what they have to offer you. See if it's a fit for you. Get yourself prepared. Do yourself this favor right now while you still have time. Don't be idiotic about this. It's coming. It's coming, people. You got to be prepared. So check out My Patriot Supply and go through our website, preparewithmacroaggressions.com.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. My name's Charlie Robinson. I am your host. Thanks for checking us out. Certainly do appreciate it. I know you have a lot of choices out there. If you want information about the show, you can go to our website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can find my social media there and also listed in the description of the podcast. I've done maybe, 200 interviews about my book on a variety of different platforms and shows. And I always have to sort of talk about the backstory of how this book came to be, why I decided to write it. And it has to do with a book written by John Perkins called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And that's going to be the topic of this episode, is regime change and the process behind regime change, how it works, how this is facilitated. And so I'll retell the story just in case anyone hasn't heard how I sort of came about this. So it was March of 2007.
I was living in Las Vegas. I was working in new home sales. I'd been doing that for a couple of years. We were in the biggest booming market in the world. I think maybe we were second only to Dubai at that time. Las Vegas was just going through the roof. It was insanity. And I was heading out on a scuba diving trip, and a buddy of mine gave me this book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. And he said, you should read this. I think you'll like it. And the book changed my life. It honestly opened my eyes to the scam of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and central banking and politics, and how this money, how the flow of money is used to reward certain countries or to cut them off if they challenge the United States in any way. And what John Perkins talks about was, he was an economic hitman. That was the name they gave themselves. And he worked for a company called Maine. And that is the equivalent of like Bechtel or Halliburton. It's a multinational engineering firm. They build big projects, airports, hydroelectric power plants, nuclear power plants, freeway systems. You know what I mean? Big. These guys aren't building houses. They're building large infrastructure type projects. And John Perkins worked for this company. This was in the 60s and 70s. And what he would do is he would go and approach foreign governments about ideas that they had for ways in which these countries could kind of grow into, come into the, you know, the new world. You know, these third world countries could sort of elevate their status. And as a particular example, he worked a lot in the country of Ecuador. And Ecuador had a very well-respected president. And John Perkins met with him and said, listen, we've got this idea, we've got this idea for a hydroelectric power plant in your country. It'll be great. You've got the topography for it. It works. What we'll do is we could build it here, and then it'll generate all of this electricity that you can use to, you know, bring power to all of these uncivilized areas of your country. And it will also generate a ton of revenue as well. There'll be a lot of people paying for this electricity, and it'll cover the costs of construction over, I don't know, 20 years, 30 years, whatever the number was. And you'll be really glad that you did it. And so they go and approach Ecuador, and they make the pitch, and Ecuador says, well, we can't afford this. And he says, no, it's fine. We've got the financing lined up already with the IMF and the World Bank. It's no problem. You're good for it. You just tell us if you want to do it. We'll put the plans in motion, and we'll do that. And so what winds up happening is that they build the power plant. That money goes from the IMF and the World Bank, not to Ecuador. It goes straight to Maine, the company that Perkins worked for. And of course, a little bit goes to the president of Ecuador, whoever sort of greased the wheels to make this deal happen. They get a little piece. Then the power plant gets built, and it starts generating electricity, and it starts generating revenue. And as years go by, what they discover is that the revenue that it is generating is nowhere near the amount of revenue that they projected, and the amount of revenue needed to cover the debt service on this project. So they're not making enough money to pay their bills is what it comes down to. And so then John Perkins would approach them and say, hey, listen, guys, you owe us a whole lot of money on this project, and you're not paying for it. You're falling behind in your payments, and this is a huge problem, but I think we can work something out. Either I've got a proposal for you. You can vote our way in a UN resolution, vote with the United States, or you can privatize your fishing industry, or you can agree to put a U.S. military base there, or whatever, you name it. It's like a loan shark who goes back to them and says, with a baseball bat, I ought to break your legs because you owe us a lot of money, but I think we might be able to work something out. That is the role of the IMF and the World Bank. They are not there to help you out. They're not there to help developing countries. They say they are, but they're not. They are there to enslave third world countries. They are there to loan money out to countries that cannot afford it and then call that note in and watch the country squirm when they can't when they realize they can't pay for it. Either the payments don't pencil out or they just call the note due. That's something that happens from time to time. Now, I'm reading this book and I'm having this epiphany that I am living a smaller, scaled down, localized version of this in real estate in Las Vegas in 2007. I am watching the banks extend credit to people that have no business getting mortgages to buy homes. And then what later happened, of course, was that everything crashed and the banks took back those homes. They loaned out fiat imaginary currency that is created through fractional reserve banking, which is frankly a whole nother episode that we won't go into, but it's money. It's legalized money printing that happens in the banking system where they're allowed to loan out money that they don't currently have. And so they're loaning out money that they don't have. They're creating mortgages for people that shouldn't have them. And then when the people default, then they take back the tangible assets. They take back the house. They take back whatever they can get their hands on. Now, in Ecuador's case, you know, the World Bank was taking back fishing rights or lumber industries or whatever it was. They were taking something tangible back from them. And so it, you know, I remember in particular a specific example of this. I was selling a house to a guy. The house was $405,000. The guy came in to buy the house. He really wanted it. We ran his credit. He qualified for this house. He made, I think, $10 an hour. I might be wrong. It might have been $15 an hour. It doesn't matter. The guy was a gardener. He was a landscaper. He cut grass and cut trees and did all that stuff. Had a consistent job. Had been doing his job for a long, long time. He was, by all accounts, a decent, great guy, you know. But he was buying a $400,000 house with an income that didn't allow him to really cover the payment. Maybe he could. Maybe he could just barely squeak by and cover the payments, right? But he couldn't afford anything else. And he was so excited to buy this house. And what I didn't realize either, was that, you know, because I was totally drinking the Kool-Aid. Like I kept thinking things are going to continue to go up or maybe they'll level off, but I didn't expect like a massive crash that we got. I should have. I understand it now, but at the time when you're in it, you know, I wasn't some evil guy trying to push people into buying houses, knowing that they were going to get the houses taken back. I was doing the same thing. I was getting, you know, I had a house and I had another house, a rental house, and I was going to, you know, build up this real estate empire because things were booming. By the way, full disclosure, I lost both houses to short sales, but, So what's going on is that this guy's trying to buy a house he can't afford, and we're telling him he can afford it. So in his mind, he's like, well, I got to be able to afford it. You know, I mean, they wouldn't loan me the money if I couldn't pay for it, right? If they didn't think I was good for it. After all, it's their money that they're loaning me, right? What? So I'm having this, I'm reading this book by Perkins, and I'm realizing, you know, that I'm living the same sort of thing. And it's banking. The banking people that are behind this are evil. You know, they understand this. They know that this is how you know, how they can acquire tangible assets. If you pay your bills every month and pay for the house, then fine, they get their money back plus interest. But if you don't, they take that house back. Oh, and by the way, they also have insurance policies on all these houses. So on all these mortgages. So if you default on your mortgage, they're getting made whole by an insurance company anyway. Not to mention then they're taking back the house. So I then later watched this a couple of years afterwards as Goldman Sachs set up their vulture funds and they were picking up all the houses that they could for, you know, 20, 30 cents on the dollar. From these other banks that had or all these mortgage companies that had the mortgages on these houses, they were selling them off to vulture funds by Citigroup and Goldman Sachs that were coming in, buying them up, sticking renters in there, and then just waiting and waiting and waiting a couple years and then selling them all off, which is exactly what they did. So this book that's talking about something, you know, seemingly unrelated to what I'm going through, it turns out was the book that changed my life, because it made me wake up to the fact that the banking industry is very much tied to the governments, and that they work hand in hand to enslave humanity. And part of how they do this on a geopolitical scale is they're both involved in regime change operations. The banks are too. You might not think that. On the surface, it doesn't seem, you know, it doesn't jump out at you that banks would be behind this. But it's not just banks. It's big business in general. We can just use Venezuela as an example, semi-currently, I guess, as Venezuela and the push for Juan Guaido to become the president of Venezuela, who is 100% CIA-backed. People in Venezuela, I think the statistics were something like only 20% of the people in Venezuela had even heard of the guy. He was not democratically elected. He was not the president of Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro is the president of Venezuela. And you can say what you want, socialism versus capitalism and all that stuff. But the reality is that Nicolas Maduro is the president of Venezuela, not Juan Guaido. But the United States is involved in regime change operations all over the world. And what winds up happening is that big businesses piggyback, on the government with situations like this. So if you think that ExxonMobil is not involved with the CIA in the coup to overthrow Nicolas Maduro, you're out of your mind, because of course they are. He's nationalized the oil. He says this is the Venezuelan people's oil. It's our country. It's our oil. I intend to keep the revenues and the proceeds from the sale of oil with the people. Well, the United States is like, no fucking way is that happening. We're not interested in that taking place at all. We're going to get rid of you. We'll fund your opponent. We'll assassinate you if we have to. If you remember that presentation, that speech he was giving, and something blew up in the air that looked like a drone. I'm not saying that that was the CIA necessarily, but it very well could have been. So this is how it happens, and it happens quite often. You've got oil companies and big banks sitting there waiting for a change in leadership so that they can come in and set up their operations. And this happens quite often. In 1953, the United States created civil unrest in Iran to remove the democratic government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, and to replace it with a dictator of their choosing. In this particular case, it was an Iranian general who was later known as the Shah of Iran. That was a CIA puppet that was put into place in Iran in order to make sure that they sold oil to the United States at a decent price. And that's really what it comes down to. I mean, it's not all that complicated. It's about money, and it's about oil and mineral resources and things like that, tangible assets. So why, you ask, did the United States feel the need to jump in the middle of someone else's business in Iran? Well, because Mossadegh was nationalizing Iran's oil, meaning he was taking the oil that is drilled in Iran and keeping it for Iran. American oil companies did not like that idea. They wanted to drill for oil in Iran and then pay the country a small fee in exchange for drilling there. And so in order to get back to this arrangement, put an end to the nationalizing of the oil, the CIA created unrest in Iran, destabilizing the existing government. And then they placed the Shah in as the new prime minister. And pretty soon he stopped the nationalization of the country's oil and brought back the American oil companies. That's how it works. People look at Venezuela. Well, wonder what's going on there. The exact same thing. Literally the exact same thing. You've got a democratically elected president The United States, who wants to nationalize the oil, the United States says, no, we don't like that. Like the arrogance of the United States to just start looking around the globe and going, oh, we don't like what you're doing there. We've got to stop that. And then the audacity to scream about how they're spreading democracy. I mean, give me a fucking break already. All right. We're not spreading democracy there. We're spreading regime change operations. And John Perkins said this. He said, this empire, unlike any other in the history of the world, has been built primarily through economic manipulation, through cheating, through fraud, through seducing people into our way of life, through the economic hitman. I was very much a part of that. Now, John Perkins has gone on to do a lot of really great and important work. I think he felt bad about his role in this. He has been very involved in areas in the rainforest to try and stop industrialized growth there and to retain rights for the indigenous people. He's a fighter for that. He got off on the wrong foot, of course, by being an economic hitman, and he of course acknowledges that, but to his credit, he has gone on to do some pretty remarkable things in that region. And so credit to him. And also I credit him a great deal for explaining the scam, explaining the game. You know that game of three card Monte that people play on the streets in New York City, where you got to pick where the, which card it is, the ace of spades or whatever, and they move them all, they shuffle them around really fast. Well, that's a rigged game, And once you understand how that game is played and how it actually works, then you won't fall for it anymore. And so I thank John Perkins for showing me how the game works with this, because now I understand it better. And to, like I said, to his credit, he's done some important work after the fact. In fact, you can still go do tour groups with him where he takes you through, like Machu Picchu and through the rainforest and anyway, interesting stuff. Chris Hedges, author, lecturer, host of On Contact on RT, he said, because we don't maintain our infrastructure, American cities are collapsing. This is how empires die, hollowed from inside. We have expanded beyond our capacity to sustain ourselves, and, like all empires, brought back into the heart of empire a brutal mechanism of control that is used on the edges of empires. That's how you get militarized police units that use deadly force indiscriminately on unarmed citizens. He's talking about the American empire. He's talking about the American empire focusing on the expansion of the empire at the destruction of its own infrastructure, meaning we're so concerned with spreading democracy, whatever that means, into all of these foreign countries that we've lost sight of the fact that we need it ourselves. We need to fix our infrastructure. Our cities are collapsing while we're trying to concoct new devious ways to overthrow some government leader that's not playing ball with us. It's the priorities of the United States are just insane when you look at what they focus on at the expense of other things. But it's not limited to Iran. We did that with the overthrowing Mossadegh and installing the Shah. And then a year later, we set about to knock some sense into Guatemala so that the democratically elected government came under fire from this manufactured fake civil unrest. And soon the government of Arbenz was thrown overboard. And, what injustice had the government of Guatemala committed? Well, after establishing a minimum wage a decade earlier, the government took it one step further by giving the land back to the peasants. And this was the last straw for the United Fruit Company. So it is alleged, I think it's more than alleged, that they enlisted the help of the CIA. And the capital of the country was literally bombed by the CIA on behalf of a banana distributor. Think about that for a second. Well, it's probably more accurate to say that United Fruit was a front company for the CIA, but they were definitely in the banana business. So a new government was put in place, and the whole giving land to the poor thing that they were doing prior, yeah, that was brought to a bloody end pretty quick. But hey, look on the bright side. At least you get your bananas cheaper, right? That's what it's all about. Then you move to 1973, and there was a coup in Chile where the democratically elected socialist president Salvador Allende was suicided so that the psychopathic Augusto Pinochet could be installed into a leadership position. Good friend of Henry Kissinger, I might add. What a surprise there, right? And once again, the CIA financed and created the uprising, the civil unrest in the country, and upwards of 30,000 Chileans disappeared, just vanished because of this. This is how they do it. This is what they do. In fact, you know what? Sting wrote a song about it called They Dance Alone on one of his solo albums. And here's some of the lyrics from it. It's, you might not have, you've heard the song maybe, you know, 100 times before, but the lyrics are quite haunting. It says, "Hey, Mr. Pinochet, you've sown a bitter crop. It's foreign money that supports you. One day the money's going to stop. No wages for your torturers, no budgets for your guns. Can you think of your own mother dancing with her invisible son? They're dancing with the missing. They're dancing with the dead. They dance with the invisible ones. Their anguish is unsaid. They're dancing with their fathers. They're dancing with their sons. They're dancing with their husbands. They dance alone." So that's, it's a spooky song about what happened in Chile that led to the disappearance of, obviously death of 30,000 people. So that what? So that the CIA could stick a new leader in there, and America has the audacity to complain about Russian interference in the elections? Give me a break, okay? Just stop with that nonsense. If anyone knows anything about interference in elections, it is the United States, and they are very good at doing it. But once again, it's not limited to this, to these countries. It goes on and on, especially in Central and South America. The United States government has removed existing leaders and installed governments friendly to them in Panama, Honduras, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, Mexico, and Congo. And don't forget about Iraq. Don't forget about Afghanistan. They're on there too. Don't forget about Libya. They're trying to do it in Syria. Assad's gassing his own people. Stop. Stop. No, he's not. These are lies. These are the lies that the media tells you that come from CIA unknown sources inside the Defense Department. Sources close to the action report that the chemical gas was Assad who's gassing his own people. No. These are lies. This is how they do it. They destabilize people through creating false narratives about what's really going on. They get us, the public, all fired up. Go in there. You got to go in there and get this guy. He's gassing his own people. Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurds. Yes, he did gas the Kurds. He actually did gas the Kurds with chemical weapons that we sold him. Where's the outrage? Well, we can't have these dictators gassing their own people with canisters from us. Maybe we shouldn't have sold him gas if we didn't want him to gas people. Maybe the real answer is we don't give a shit if he gasses his own people or gasses the Kurds. Do you think we care? You think we, our government, cares? They don't care. They don't care. They don't get bogged down with that stuff at all. Libya sets out to challenge the petrodollar with a gold-backed dinar proposed by Muammar Gaddafi. What happened to him? He got a knife stuck up his ass and was murdered on video. Oh, and the gold-backed dinar never came into existence. Libya was like the highest quality of living in all of Africa. And we bombed that place. We bombed the hell out of that place. Just and ran guns through that hub of Libya on its way to Turkey and then found its way to Syria. That's what Benghazi was all about. That murderous psychopath Hillary Clinton, who was behind that, wasn't caused by a YouTube video. The uprising wasn't caused from a YouTube video. Stop! This is like gassing his own people. Sorts of nonsense. We have to be better about this. We have to be able to pick up these lies because they're never going to stop. You think it ends with Libya or Syria? It goes on and on and on. Here are a list of the countries that have had their governments covertly ousted by the United States. Iran, 1953. Guatemala, 1954. British Guiana. Iraq, 1963. Cambodia. Laos. Ecuador. Congo. Brazil. Dominican Republic. Bolivia. Indonesia. Ghana. Chile. Greece. Bolivia again. Australia. Portugal. Jamaica. Chad. Grenada. Fiji, Nicaragua, Panama, Bulgaria, Albania, Afghanistan, Yugoslavia, Ecuador, Afghanistan again, Venezuela, Iraq, Haiti, Libya, Ukraine. That's a long list. But we can't have Russian interference in our election. Yeah, that's the problem. That's the problem. It's those damn Russians spending $100,000 on Facebook ads. Oh, if only we could stop them. I mean, it didn't have anything to do with Hillary Clinton giving up on her campaign towards the end, mailing it in, and being the worst candidate to run for president. A candidate so despicable and so unlikable that she lost to Donald fucking Trump. You think about that. It could have been like Weekend at Bernie's. You could have put up anybody. You could have put up Beetlejuice from the Howard Stern show and he would have beat Donald Trump. But Hillary Clinton, to you, that's not, whatever. That's not. You want to hear a list of the countries that have had an attempted overthrow of their government by the United States? Oh, this is a good list too. China, Albania, East Germany, Costa Rica? Why are you doing that to Costa Rica? Syria, Egypt, Indonesia, North Vietnam, France, Cuba, Costa Rica again, how dare you? Zaire, Angola, Seychelles, South Yemen, Suriname, Libya, Iraq, Somalia again, Honduras, and Syria. These are all in different years. So some of them, the United States tried to take out, but couldn't. And so they came back and got them, you know, later. Like, you know, Iraq in 1991, didn't really get the job done, so we had to come back and get Iraq in 2003, which of course we did. So this is unfortunately how the United States views other countries. All this diplomacy and this United Nations nonsense, it's about getting these countries to play ball with the dictates of the United States government. It's not about the United States people. It's not about Americans. We're for the most part good people. We're not, you know, when I say the United States is doing this, I don't mean it's, you know, Dave and Steve down from the local bar that they're getting in their pickup truck and organizing these coups or anything like that. I'm talking about the people at the highest level of government, the permanent government, the people in the intelligence agencies, the people in the think tanks, those psychopathic people that, you know, the people that are running companies like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and RAND Corporation and all of these globalist think tank, companies that make money and profit from destabilizing other countries and keeping the world on uneasy footing so that there's always a conflict or multiple conflicts going on all around the world. They don't call it United States of Lockheed Martin for nothing. That's a company that basically runs the United States government. They have a ton of power, and they thrive in conditions of destabilized governments and countries that are on the brink, because what happens? Wars break out, ammunition is used, missiles are used, planes are used, and that's what they're selling. So they're always selling more. It's a war economy, unfortunately, when you're the United States. We could be an economy of all kinds of things, but we choose to be a war economy, which is reprehensible and it's short-sighted, and it will eventually be the downfall of the United States empire, because like every empire, you spread yourself so thin that you can't sustain it. And your military thins out and you've got too many people that are damaged. We're seeing it right now. You know, the United States military is not doing well after two decades of constant war. Yeah, there's $1 trillion flowing into these companies every year from the government. But you've got broken people. You've got defective products like the F-35, which is an unmitigated disaster. I'm convinced it's a form of money laundering. So the empire building and the regime change operations go hand in hand. They are trying to build empires by capturing other countries. Some of the countries go easily and quietly and they get on board with the plan. Others do not. And the ones that do not get on board with the American empire plan are the ones that you know about. Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Venezuela, Cuba. All the countries that are demonized around the world or in the United States, they're demonized as being rogue, danger. North Korea, Iran, axis of evil. Ooh, the axis of evil. There's nothing inherently evil about these countries. I'm not a fan of North Korea. Obviously, I think they're doing some weird things there. But the axis of evil is just such projection on the part of the United States and George W. Bush. Because if we were being intellectually honest about this, the axis of evil would be the United States, the United Kingdom, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. That's who the real axis of evil is. And I take no pleasure saying that. As an American, with friends that are from the UK, with other friends that I know grew up in Saudi Arabia, and with plenty of Jewish friends that aren't necessarily Israelis, but you know what I mean. So I wish I didn't feel that way. I wish I didn't see the world that way. I wish I could just swallow the official line that these countries are all out there trying to get us. They're not out there trying to get us. Stop. Stop that. Stop believing that. That's lazy thinking. There are some countries that are very angry at us, at the United States, with good reason. Obviously, now there's a reason for them to hate us. But it's not hating us for our freedom, right, W? They hate us for our freedoms. No, they don't. No. We hate them because they will not accept central banks. We hate them because they want to privatize their own oil industry and use that resource to help themselves grow. We don't like that. We don't want that. We want control of that. We want ExxonMobil in there pumping that oil. We don't want Maduro to pump that oil and sell it on the open market and turn Venezuela into one of the wealthiest countries in the world. That goes against the American empire's plan. The government of the United States is drunk on power. The way they behave is like going into a bar and that one guy at the end of the night that is just hammered and he's putting his finger in everybody's chest he's bigger than them, and he's talks louder, and he's imposing, and he's putting his finger in your chest, and he's talking shit to everybody in that bar. And one day, or some guy is going to stand up and knock that man out for being a jerk, for intimidating and threatening everybody in that bar. One day, some guy is just going to stand up and knock that son of a bitch out. And that's what's going to happen to the United States Empire. That is coming. We have it coming to us. Our behavior, once again, not my behavior, not your behavior, the behavior of the American Empire, the government organizations and the like, and the media and the banking and all those components, they're asking for it. We have burned bridges with so many countries around the world. And one day, you know that it's coming. And it may be that everyone in the world, all the other major countries in the world, get together and decide that they no longer choose to use the United States dollar as the world's reserve currency. And I'll tell you what, when that day comes, and it's coming, that's going to be the end of Wall Street. You want it? You think Wall Street market sell-offs in March of 2020 are a big deal? Wait till the U.S. dollar is reserved as the world reserve currency. It would be catastrophic. And I will tell you that it used to be that the dollar was backed by gold. And they took the U.S. off the gold standard in 1971, Richard Nixon did, to battle the speculators. What a lying sack of shit that guy was. No, that's not why they did it. They did it, they took it off of gold so that they could infinitely print as much money as they wanted. And that's, of course, what they've done. But there comes a day when people do not believe and trust in the United States dollar. That day is already happening. I would say that, to be more accurate, the United States dollar is backed by something. It's not gold. It's the United States military. And that's no way to prop up your currency by threatening everybody to use it or else they'll get invaded. At some point, people will go around that and they'll decide, maybe we're not interested in doing that. We're not interested in participating in this game. And it's one of those things where if one country does it, it doesn't have an impact. In fact, they'll get themselves singled out and invaded, i.e. Libya. But when they all get together and have a conversation and they say, they come to an agreement that, hey, why don't we all simultaneously decide not to use it? It's over. It's over. The game is over. United States quality of life would instantly be impacted. What that looks like, 30% impact, 50%, 70%, I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not an economist. Don't want to be one. But I do understand how that works. I do understand that the reason there's a demand for U.S. dollars is because of the relationship that the United States has with Saudi Arabia and the oil-backed dollar, the petrodollar, that all oil in the world is sold on marketplace in U.S. dollars. So if you're a country, if you're China and you want to buy oil from Venezuela, you have to buy it from Venezuela in U.S. dollars. That's sort of how the system is set up. Now, a lot of these countries are getting together and they're like, as an example, China and Venezuela, China's saying to Venezuela, ooh, it looks like the United States doesn't like you. They don't like what you're doing. And Venezuela says, yeah, they're really after us. They don't like that we're nationalizing our oil. And so China says, well, listen, I'll tell you what, we'll pay you in yuan for it. You know, we'll pay you and we'll find another way to pay you. We'll pay you in a variety. We'll trade for you. You want to give us your oil, we'll trade, we'll give you products instead. So there's ways around it. And part of what's happening in the world, the threatening of the United States, the demonization of China and everything has to do with these countries trying to move off of the petrodollar and the world, the US dollar is the world reserve currency, and trading without it. And that creates gigantic problems. And this is how empires crumble. And the United States is dealing with that and panicking and freaking out and overreacting. In 2014, the Obama administration, went after French bank BNP Paribas for dealing with both Iran and Cuba, who, you know, the United States considers to be enemies. So you might ask, what have Iran and Cuba done to piss off America so much? Well, they're two of the last three countries that don't have a Rothschild-controlled central bank operating inside them. I wonder why they're hated. I wonder why they're on the watch list. I wonder why they're part of the Axis of Evil. Ooh, who's the third one? North Korea. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. This is the way of controlling the rest of the world, because the rules stipulate that all trades must be conducted in U.S. dollars, thus propping up the dollar regardless of the trillions and trillions of dollars in debt that we are. It's been it's fascinating to watch how this game plays out, but it is it's a loser strategy that eventually comes off, unless you become the world's reserve currency and then you go about taking your currency to help out all the countries around the world. That's a different story. Yeah, it makes it a whole lot easier if we've got one currency or one strong currency that everyone can sort of count on. But when the country in charge of that currency, the United States, is so unbelievably evil to everybody else, what they're doing is they're incentivizing all these other countries to look for a way out, look for someone else to run this system. They don't want to be a part of it. So if the United States had just taken a position of using this extraordinary gift that we've got, which is having a currency that is the world reserve currency, it allows you to basically like print money, really just print money like crazy. I think the countries of the world would go for it, even if we were still printing money like crazy, as long as we weren't being evil about it. But we just can't help ourselves, it seems. So what happened with BNP Paribas when they were discovered to be dealing with Iran and Cuba? Well, the United States fined the French bank that was dealing with Iran and Cuba, not an American bank, mind you. The United States fined a French bank $9 billion for dealing with Iran and Cuba. And you know what? They paid it. They paid the fine. And do you know why they paid the fine? Because they wanted the United States government to just leave them alone. They knew that if they didn't, they would be shut out of the banking clearing process. And that would cost them far more than $9 billion. That's what the mob calls a shakedown. And it happens every single day when countries and companies deal with the arrogant United States. They get shook down. Like, nice flower shop you had there. Be a shame if something bad happened to it. That's what the United States is. Government is. Gangsters. Straight gangsters. Run by guys like George H.W. Bush who say things like this. I will never apologize for the United States. I don't care what the facts are. I'm not an apologize for America kind of guy. Well, you know what you should be, George. You sack of shit, you. Starting wars, murdering people, disturbing relationships with children. Yeah. He should be apologizing for himself, not just America. We have Tulsi Gabbard running for president, and she's running on a platform of no more regime change wars. And that's kind of what I'm talking about. We've been involved in this military adventurism where we go off to foreign countries and kick off regime change wars. Some of them are outright, you know, traditional wars. Like when we think of wars, we usually have a picture in our heads of foxholes dug in the ground and bullets whizzing by and bombs going off and people getting blown to pieces and all that stuff. But some wars aren't fought using conventional weapons, but rather with debt as an instrument of destruction. It's less bloody, but probably more effective. Doesn't have the same, you know, nightmarish reputation as bullets and bombs, but debt has led to the deaths of more people on this planet than all the wars put together. And Peter Joseph, who's the director of Zeitgeist, had an interesting take on this. He said, "Our entire system, in an economic sense, is based on restriction. Scarcity and inefficiency are the movers of money. The more there is of any resource, the less you can charge for it. The more problems there are, the more opportunities there are to make money. This reality is a social disease, for people can actually gain off the misery of others and the destruction of the environment. Efficiency, abundance, and sustainability are enemies of our economic structure, for they are inverse to the mechanics required to perpetuate consumption. This is profoundly critical to understand, for once you put this together, you begin to see that the 1 billion people currently starving on this planet, the endless slums of the poor, and all the horrors of a culture due to poverty and depravity are not natural phenomena due to some natural human order or lack of earthly resources. They are products of the creation, perpetuation, and preservation of artificial scarcity and inefficiency." That is very insightful and unbelievably accurate as a way to describe what's going on here. And the United States is involved in that. When you hear statistics about 40% of the planet living on less than $2 a day, you must understand that the weapon responsible for this enslavement is debt. And the way in which a country finds itself saddled with massive debt that can never be paid off is a calculated method that John Perkins explains in great detail in his books. And he should know. He was a part of the problem back then, until he saw what the United States does to men of principle and integrity and decided to change his ways. And what he saw was that in a couple of different cases, he had approached these presidents, Jaime Rolos and General Omar Trujillo's, about taking this, you know, silver or the lead, essentially, you know, that motto, take the silver or you get the lead. And these two men were adamant that they weren't participating in that. They knew what he was doing. They understood that what he was trying to accomplish. He became friends with them. Perkins became friends with both of these two guys. And he told them, listen, you know, this is a much bigger operation than you understand. You need to take the deal. And both of these guys said no. And he said, listen, I'm telling you, what comes next is that the jackals come for you. And they said, we know. We know what happens next. And Perkins backed off. The jackals came in, meaning the killers. And within 3 months, both of those guys had blown up in separate plane crashes. Explosions on planes while they were flying. And they knew it was coming. That's what happens. That's the United States. That's the United States foreign policy right there. Play ball and you'll get rich. Go against us and you'll blow up in a plane crash. Think it doesn't happen? It happens all the time. Unfortunately. That is our specialty, is blowing up important people in plane crashes. So the concept of regime changes are always pushed by empire. And the thing about empires is that they follow a fairly predictable cycle. And Sir John Glubb, who is a Brit, he, you know, having seen his own British Empire fade away as the world superpower throughout the 20th century, he wrote a book called The Fate of Empires in 1978. And he argues that great civilizations start with and end in very predictable ways as they make their way through the different, you know, stages of this. So he defines these as different ages, right? Or different periods. And it starts with the period called the Age of Pioneers. These are hardworking pioneers. They cement their place in local legend as big deals in their homeland. They eventually end up looking to expand their reach beyond their own country of origin. And then he describes this step as the Age of Commercial Expansion. The next level is known as the Age of Affluence, where those industrial leaders become comfortable with their wealth. Then they take the next step. It becomes the Age of Intellect. It's where affluent business moguls set about to prove to the world that they weren't just lucky. You know, they didn't just get lucky with their company, but rather they are in their elite position because they're more intelligent than the rest of us, and thus, you know, they deserve praise. Then the next phase after that, things begin to sort of decay, and that is the last phase. It's called the Age of Decadence. This is where the entire society feels entitled to a level of wealth that they neither earned nor can any longer afford. And even when they are faced with obvious fiscal realities, they make no changes. Wonder where we are. I wonder where we are in this cycle. Well, we are in the last phase, of course. We are in the Age of Decadence. As we drive our monster truck to the grocery store two blocks away to buy a case of Mountain Dew and a couple bottles of expensive champagne to fill in our bathtub of our McMansion that we bought on a no-doc, zero-down, interest-only, negative amortization loan for our house. We're just not going to worry about this. We're just gonna keep our heads in the sand and blah, blah, blah. Everything's fine. Nothing could go wrong. This is a component of the Age of Decadence. You don't see it coming until it's too late. You're so full of your own arrogance and you're still at the party. You still want the music to keep playing. But this is where we are in America. And when you get to these phases, like the Age of Decadence, you do desperate things. And the American empire is doing desperate things. Regime change operations are desperate. It's like last, you know, you want to just hold on to everybody you can get. You want to threaten you want to threaten Venezuela. You want to threaten Iran. You've got to get that money. You're depending on that money. You're overextended. You've got to have them. And so they start to, you know, we in America fit this model perfectly because we act totally entitled for no good reason. We're dangerously leveraged, not just as a country, but as individuals as well. And we're either in denial of our own impending doom or we're just totally oblivious to it. I don't know which one's worse. But either way, it's not a sustainable strategy after, you know, decades of emptying the tank of our motorhome onto the rest of the world like we're Cousin Eddie, you know? We will come to find at some point the helping hand that we imagined, you know, would be outstretched for us will probably be replaced by a middle finger and, you know, shitter's full. That's what we're gearing up for. This is what we have to look forward to. You treat everybody in the world disrespectfully for so long. You invade countries with impunity. You make up lies about weapons of mass destruction. You talk about 19 Arab hijackers knocking down three buildings with two planes and decide that you're going to go into Afghanistan to settle some score. You know, at some point the world catches on that this is all a bunch of nonsense and that it seems like maybe we are the aggressors. Maybe we are the animals acting this way. And it's not going to end well for us. But this episode will end. I don't know if it'll end well or not, but I'm going to end it with something from John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, what he said that I think is important. And that is, some would blame our current problems on an organized conspiracy. I wish it were so simple. Members of a conspiracy can be rooted out and brought to justice. This system, however, is fueled by something far more dangerous than conspiracy. It is driven not by a small band of men, but by a concept that has become accepted as gospel. The idea that all economic growth benefits humankind, and that the greater the growth, the more widespread the benefits. This belief also has a corollary, that those people who excel at stoking the fires of economic growth should be exalted and rewarded, while those born at the fringes are available for exploitation. The concept is, of course, erroneous. We know that in many countries, economic growth benefits only a small portion of the population and may, in fact, result in increasingly desperate circumstances for the majority. This effect is reinforced by the corollary belief that the captains of industry who drive this system should enjoy a special status, a belief that is the root of many of our current problems and is perhaps also the reason why conspiracy theories abound. When men and women are rewarded for greed, greed becomes a corrupting motivator. When we equate the gluttonous consumption of the earth's resources with a status approaching sainthood, when we teach our children to emulate people who live unbalanced lives, and when we define huge sections of the population as subservient to an elite minority, we ask for trouble, and we get it. You can catch up with my work at theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Please share this if you like it. Well, please share it if you don't like it, too. I don't care. Do whatever you can to get the word out about it. We certainly do appreciate your support. Thank you very much.